You're listening to the Author Stories Podcast, bringing you the story behind the stories and the storytellers.
Margaret Wise,
Terry Brooks,
Sheena Kamal,
Matthew Quick,
J.T. Ellison,
Walt D. Williams,
Brad Ford,
Corey Doctorow,
Brandon Sanderson,
Robin Mom,
Ernest Klein, Jim Butcher,
Sherilyn Harris.
Visit HankGarner.com for archives of all the shows. Today's guest is
David Shannon.
Thanks for tuning in to Author Stories today. We've got a fantastic show coming up for you. But before we jump into that, let me tell you about a couple of sponsors today. RJ Pinero and his brand new book, Chilling Effect, a global climate thriller. A ruthless eco-terrorist, a woman determined to stop him. Chilling Effect, RJ Pinero's newest thriller, explores a world in the not-too-distant future where terrorism is taken to a new level, one with world-ending consequences. You never know what you're capable of until the monster inside of you pushes you beyond your moral line in the sand. These are the opening thoughts of former climatologist William Christed as he prepares to attack our delicate ecosystem. He's hell-bent on avenging his father's death and will go to extremes of terrorism never before seen, all to strike a blow to those whose hubris led to his father's demise. He will take full advantage of the greed and narcissism ever present in the world, as well as the fragility of our planet to ecological terrorism, and use it to plot a scenario so grim, yet so compellingly real, it could have ripped from today's headlines. Check out the brand new thriller Chilling Effect from RJ Pinero. Michael Anderle has a brand new series that's launching. It's called Opus X, and the first book is Obsidian Detective, two rebels whose worlds collide on a planetary level. On the fringes of human space, a murder will light a fuse and send two different people colliding together. She lives on Earth, where peace among the population is a given. He is on the fringe of society, where authority is how much power you wield. She's from the powerful, the elite. He's with the military. Both want the truth, but is revealing the truth good for society? Check out Obsidian Detective, the very first book that's up for pre-order now, from the new series Opus X by Michael Anderle. If you love comics the way I do, go check out Cool Comics in My Collection at edgosney.com. Ed runs one of the best comics blogs on the internet. New episodes each Thursday come out, digging into the things that we have loved about comics and comic collecting. There's something there for everyone. Go check out Cool Comics in My Collection at edgosney.com. Well, thanks for joining me again for the Author Stories Podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. Today, I'm super excited to have David Shannon on the show with me. He has a fantastic new book for kids. It's called Mr. Noggin Body Gets a Hammer. And, you know, if you have small kids around, you have probably stumbled over David's books before. He has an amazing collection out there, a great back catalog of books. And we're going to talk all about storytelling in a little different way today than we get a chance to very often on the show. But welcome to the show, David.
Well, thanks. Thanks for having me.
I'm excited to have you. David, we begin each show with the same question. And that question is, what is your first memory of wanting to be a writer or storyteller?
Oh, well, I actually, I always wanted to be an artist. And that's the direction I came at everything from. I went to art school and started out as an illustrator. So I have been drawing ever since I can remember. And that usually involves some sort of storytelling.
Sure. It's a form of storytelling all its own.
Yeah, exactly. The book Know David is based on a book I made when I was five. So that's a pretty good memory, right there.
That's a serious callback there. It takes a lifetime to set up that kind of callback.
Yeah, it does. But, you know, I mean, you got to take the good with the bad. It's also a little depressing to feel like you've peaked at five.
Well, you know, it happens for each of us when it happens. We're not in control of that.
Yep, you just got to take it when it comes.
That's right. So you started illustrating, drawing when you were young. You know, I am not an illustrator. I do good to draw my name. But I have a daughter. My middle daughter is infinitely creative and in the visual arts. And she would say, you know, that she hates writing and the, you know, she sees things and she can communicate what she sees. Is that a feeling that you get early on that, that you just look at the world differently than other people do and are able to bring things out of your imagination? That, like, at what point do you realize that you can do it, or is it just something that just naturally comes out?
You know, I think it's something that naturally comes out. I think a big part of it, you know, people say, oh, I don't have any talent for drawing, or I am talented with drawing or whatever, but a lot of it is just sort of a need to draw. And that's, I mean, I just liked it. I drew all the time and I still do. So it, you know, at some point I realized I could draw better than a lot of people. But a lot of it was just because I did it all the time.
Right. Well, I know you went to art school, and, we talk a lot on the show about, the gift of storytelling, or, you know, if there's a storytelling gene or whatever it is that sets some people apart, that just have a natural inclination to communicate with other people. And, you know, some people decide to become writers and then hone that craft and, you know, all that and become better at it. You know, I think there's a certain level of storytelling that you could teach anyone to do. Now, whether, you know, how well they excel at that is, you know, kind of an individual thing. But do you think you can teach people to draw and to illustrate that maybe don't show any natural talent for that?
Yeah, I think you can. You know, there's a level of craft that you can teach. But then there's also intangible elements, you know, the sort of inspiration side of things, the creative side of things. But it's always a mix of the two. And, you know, there's times when, the inspiration isn't happening. So then you fall back on the craft and they feed each other.
I like that. They feed each other. Were you a big reader as a kid?
I was a pretty big reader. I read very slowly. I still do. I read at talking speed. So my retention is good, but my quantity is not so hot. But I read all kinds of things. I loved reading books. But I also read a lot of comic books and to this day I still read the newspaper. I read a lot of, you know, periodicals and things like that. But the interesting thing was that, you know, I didn't really realize. I sort of got into children's books by accident. But once I did, I realized that whatever I was reading as a kid, I was also drawing. So, like, when I was reading The Lord of the Rings, there were drawings of hobbits and Gandalf and everything all over my room. And I read a lot of baseball biographies, so I was also drawing a lot of baseball players and that kind of thing.
Wow. I remember as a kid, I have dyslexia, and comic books, like, literally saved my life. I remember my mom getting me, we went on a road trip to my grandparents' house. She bought me a Superman and a Justice League comic, you know, in the middle 70s, and, you know, put them in the back seat with me, and that changed my life. You know, literally at 7 or 8 years old, it changed the trajectory of my life with those two comic books. And you could say that having a drawing of the scene and then, you know, going along with the narration blocks and the dialogue bubbles, you know, that's, well, the drawings are explaining what happened, but they don't necessarily. And it's actually kind of a third thing that happens with a comic book, that there's more context there. And there's I believe I rewired parts of my brain by reading comic books that allowed me to do what I do today. But But what is it? It's not just that the illustrations convey what the story is doing in another way, but it's a different thing that's happening. What is going on when we read something that's illustrated?
Well, and that's the great thing about picture books, about children's books, because more than really any other form, you know, you're telling part of the story with the words, and then you're telling an overlapping but different part of the story with the pictures. And then you put the two together and add the imagination of the reader, and that's where the whole story comes into play. So it's a little bit different for each reader, for one thing, because they bring their own experiences to it. But, you know, there's visual literacy as well as reading literacy. You know, how to understand a picture, and that's kind of a number of my books kind of deal with that, is you know, reading clues in the picture, or noticing them, where a lot of times you'll just sort of, you know, a kid will just say, oh, well, he's like this and he's like that, and they don't realize that the reason they think that is because of a little thing in the background or a pose that the character is in or something like that. And so there's an awful lot of storytelling that goes into the picture.
I remember reading a quote by Stan Lee one time where someone asked him if comic books were a legitimate form of literature. And mm-hmm. he said, well, we don't just read Shakespeare. We watch it acted out on the stage. Does that make the words less important? Because we have a visual counterpart to that. And I really liked that analogy that, you know, the words are one thing, but then the performance or the illustration of that becomes a wholly different thing.
Yeah, exactly. Well, your mom, you know, was a little ahead of her time.
Yes, she was. I think she just wanted to shut me up, but, you know.
Well, you know,
God,
when I was, these days there's pretty much of an acceptance that, you know, whatever a kid is reading, it's good. You know, just to be reading is the main thing. When I was a kid, comics were kind of, you know, poo-pooed. And the graphic novel hadn't been invented yet. And, you know, I spent a lot of time drawing comics too. And people would say, well, yeah, that's a really good drawing, but it's not art. And, these days, of course, it is considered art. So, you know, but as far as the performance goes too, you know, when I'm putting together a book, sometimes I kind of view it as a little movie, and I'm the director. So all the things like, you know, the acting, I'm also the actor because I'm drawing the characters, their body language, their facial expressions. I'm concerned with, you know, the tone of the piece, the viewpoint, the angle, the lighting, the color, all those things that you sort of associate with making a movie are also part of making a picture book.
Before you got into illustrating and then writing and illustrating children's books, you wrote more adult-themed stuff for magazines like Time and Newsweek and Rolling Stone and even for the New York Times. How was the process of writing for more adult mainstream audiences than for writing for kids?
Well, those were all illustrations. I was illustrating other people's articles. So when I got out of art school, I immediately moved to New York and, you know, started pounding the pavement with my portfolios and things like that. And I was doing editorial illustration, which is magazines, newspapers, books, and, you know, mostly really serious subject matter, you know, the op-ed page, things like that. I got into children's books kind of by accident, but the editorial illustration is kind of interesting because it's you're reading a manuscript and then distilling it down to one image. Whereas with a picture book, it's almost the opposite. You're reading or writing a manuscript and then expanding on it with the pictures. So I got into children's books basically by accident. I'd done a piece for the New York Times Book Review, an illustration for Toni Morrison's book Beloved. And an editor at Scholastic saw that piece, and she had a collection of African and Jewish folktales by Julius Lester. So she called me up and said, would I be interested in doing a children's book? And I said, well, that, you know, that sounds like fun. And, it was a nice break from the 24-hour deadlines of newspaper work. And so I said, oh, you know, and then I could say, oh yeah, I did a children's book once. so I did.
Everybody
it,
needs one of those on their resume.
Yeah, right, exactly. Yeah. And it was first of all, I really enjoyed it. And then when that book came out, other people saw that and sent me more manuscripts. And, it was really an eye opener, you know, that how expansive and deep the stories were in children's books. I really didn't realize that, and so I did another and another, and then before long I realized that's really what I had always liked to do my whole life. You know, like I said, when I was reading a book, I was drawing pictures of what I pictured in my head of the book. And I also found that I was drawing a lot of the same things I drew as a kid. You know, when I was a kid, I drew these big epic battles of knights and witches and things like that, and baseball players and Indians and animals and things like that. And I looked at the books I was doing, and they were about knights and pirates and Indians and baseball players, and so it really it had the feel of destiny to it, Hank.
So how do you go from illustrating for other folks to writing and illustrating your own stories? How does that transition happen?
Well, that was kind of interesting because, yeah, like I said, when I started in children's books, I wasn't writing them. I was writing other people's, I was illustrating other people's stories. Usually they kind of keep the illustrator and the author separated, mainly for the illustrator's benefit, I think, so he doesn't feel like the author's looking over his shoulder the whole time. But it was just, you know, I was reading the story and then illustrating what I saw, just like when I was a kid. And of course I got better and better at, the tricks of telling a story, with the picture. And I'd try to expand on the words. So, you know, I'd be thinking, well, okay, what else might this character be doing? What else can I put in this illustration that's going to accent his personality or his situation? A lot of times people didn't even realize that, you know, there was a whole bunch of the story that wasn't in the words, because you try to make that feel very naturally. And then when I started writing, that was great, because then I didn't have to sort of go through the editor. If I wanted to make a change, I just made a change. Instead of going through the editor and saying, you know, what does the author think if I put this in, or can he change that? And, you know, and also if there was something that, that I couldn't draw, I'd just take it out of the story. So, but also, but it's interesting too, because each book is just a little different. People always ask me, you know, well, do you write the story first, or do you draw the pictures, or what do you, how do you do that? And it's a little different for every book. There's some books where I just write the story and then illustrate it like it was pretty much like it was somebody else's story. There's other books that I will start with some images and build a story from there. But I'm always thinking, even when I'm writing, I'm thinking in images. So, you know, I'm having fun with the words, but I'm picturing everything in my head. And there's other books that, you know, kind of start with a concept, and it's a mixture of like the No David series. I start with, phrases, you know, timeless phrases that moms, always, how they say no to their kids, for instance. And then I'll also make a list of stuff kids do to get in trouble. And then I start mixing and matching, you know, well, you know, stop that this instant. We'll go with the, this picture of him picking his nose or whatever, you know. And so that's kind of, you know, kind of building blocks and rearranging things.
Well, you've done a number of children's books, both illustrated and the ones that you've written and illustrated. But the ones that really jump out at me are the No David series, mm-hmm. Books, and they seem to be so much fun. And you've talked about the, you know, this love from early on, and is the No David series? Are you mining yourself for material here?
I always refer to David in the third person, but it is semi autobiographical, I would say. I didn't do all the things he does. Some of them were things that my brother did, or my friends did, or my nephew, and then I have a daughter who's actually, she's just about to turn 21, but she was also an inspiration for various books. No David is based on a book I made when I was a little kid, which was also called No David. It was 8 pages long, and I made a bunch of drawings of me doing stuff I wasn't supposed to do. And the only words in the whole book are No and David, because that's all I knew how to spell.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah, it's pretty wild. My mom saved it. And when I was got started in children's books, I was visiting her, and she kind of has this magic closet she pulls things out of from my childhood, and she pulled out a portfolio of artwork, and in there was this No David book, and I said, you know, this might make a good children's book. So I wrote a few more words and drew new pictures, but that's where the kind of 5-year-old drawing style came from too. Right. When I first started to work it up into a book, I was drawing it more realistically, and it just fell flat. I said, well, what is it about that original that, you know, really attracted me? So I tried drawing like a 5-year-old, and that's when it completely came alive. So all sorts of things from the No David children's book, I kept going back to the original whenever I got stuck with anything. So like the pointy teeth and the type style, the drawing style, even a couple of the incidents are from the original book.
That's amazing. Your new book, Mr. Noggin Body Gets Hammered, which is out everywhere today, it's a brand new release, and everyone should go grab their copy in hardcover or Kindle. This is a little different. This is a new take on an old concept, an old fairy tale. When a lot of people decide to try their hand at children's books, they think, these are short books. Are you there, David?
Yeah, I lost you for a sec.
Okay, yeah. A lot of people, when they decide to try their hand at children's books, they assume these are simple projects that you could just knock out quickly, and a children's author, illustrator ought to just be able to just churn out material because it's super simple, and these are made for little people, and they don't understand a lot. And what you learn very quickly is that there is an art to telling a story simply while engaging with your audience. When you start to have an idea for a new story like Mr. Noggin Body Gets a Hammer, where does that begin for you? Do you begin with an idea, with maybe a character that's kind of captured your imagination, and then how do you decide to move out from there?
Yeah, they're deceptively simple.
Right.
The idea is to have, all sorts of several layers of meaning, contained in one very simple story. The trick is trying to get it down to 32 pages.
Right.
That's where that's where the magic of children's books are. Of course, I look at somebody who writes a novel and go, how can you possibly keep everything straight writing 400 pages?
And drone on and on and on for 400
Yeah, it just
pages.
Seems impossible to me to do that. But each book is a little bit different. Sometimes it'll start with a concept. Sometimes it'll start with an image. Sometimes it'll start with the title. So for instance, Too Many Toys, that started with the title. I stepped on a toy and it hurt. And I yelled to my daughter, "Emma, you have too many toys." And it kind of went ding. I said, "That sounds like a good title." So, and then the story followed from there. For a book called A Bad Case of Stripes, which is about a little girl who breaks out in different colored stripes instead of chicken pox, that started with just a sort of that image. I woke up one morning and I said, "Wouldn't it be weird if you got stripes instead of chicken pox?" And I pictured this little girl in bed with stripes and a thermometer, and that's what's on the cover of the book. So then I had to figure out, why she got stripes and what happened after she got them and how she got cured and all that. So the whole story came later. Mr. Noggin Body started with the character. I was just kind of doodling in my sketchbook. And sometimes I just start drawing kind of, just goofy little guys and stuff. And Mr. Noggin Body came out of that. And I said, I like that guy. I usually find maybe I'm just immature, but I usually find if something amuses me that it's going to amuse kids too. So I started kind of just, knocking around ideas for what this guy could do. And he was kind of a surrealistic little figure. He's called Mr. Noggin Body because his whole head is his body. He doesn't really have a body. He's just a head with arms and legs and a bowler hat. So I thought, maybe it sort of lent itself to doing something a little absurdist. So I fooled around with different stories, the saying, "If all you have is a hammer, every problem looks like a nail. I'd always liked that phrase called the law of the instrument. And so I started applying that to Mr. Noggin Body, and I was just sketching in my sketchbook with him. So this was a big departure because I started drawing the book in my sketchbook. Usually I have this whole process of doing thumbnails and then drawing the full-size illustrations in pencil and refining them, and this is all done at my drawing table, and then I take those sketches and I paint them, and that's what I intended to do with Noggin Body, but I just kept drawing the whole thing in pen and ink and whiteout in my sketchbook, and when it came time to paint, I said, you know, I really like these little drawings. I like the immediacy of them. I like what the whiteout does, too. So I got them photographed and printed on nice paper, and then applied paint to the prints and did a little refinement here and there, and that's what the finishes ended up being. So it's a much more immediate kind of feel to them, and very sketchy, and you know, I leave lines in that aren't supposed to be there and stuff like that.
and before you knew it, you had a book.
Yeah,
that's I'm sure your agent and publisher are excited for those little happy accidents like that.
Yeah. Well, and we have there's another Mr. Noggin Body in the can, as we say. Nice. Next year there'll be another one too.
Nice. Well, another big mistake that people that try to write for children make, and I think this happens, this is probably the rule rather than the exception that a lot of, as far as writers' mistakes are, is that they feel the need to pack some sort of meaning and lesson into the book to the point of robbing all of the fun of the book. And I think that happens with just about everyone who tries this at some point. And some people learn how to get out of that, and some people just never, you know, become successful children's authors because of that. How do you balance because like with Mr. Noggin Body, you've got the great parable, you've got the, you know, if everything's a hammer, if all you have is a hammer, then everything's a nail. That's a very deep, rich, there's lots to be taken away from that. Yet you bring it about in such a fun way that you get some insight into the world and insight into human nature, and you don't even know it. How do you balance those things?
Yeah, and not only that, but you get to smash things.
Exactly. Exactly.
But well, for me, first and foremost, it's about the fun. I want the kid, even if it's a serious story, I want it to be fun. Whether, you know, because, I mean, being scared or whatever, that can be fun, too. Whenever I've tried to write a story about a message, you know, with a certain message, it's terrible. It comes off as stilted and I have to start over. So one of the things I do is I try to have fun myself. So, you know, Mr. Noggin Body just makes me crack up. There were several times when I'm drawing him that I just start chuckling because he's such a goofball. And the other thing is I try to listen to the story and let it tell me what it wants to be. If I try to shoehorn it into a message or something like that, that's when it really falls flat. So I like to, you know, sort of let the story tell me what it's trying to be. And if I can lock into that, then usually all sorts of things fall into place. It's almost like these stories exist somewhere in the ether. You know, you hear songwriters, if you read an interview with a songwriter, they'll say, oh, I'm just a conduit kind of, you know, such a, and it does seem that way sometimes. Michelangelo said that the sculpture that he was doing already exists in the block of marble, and that his job was to just get rid of everything else until there it was. And to some degree, I think writing a children's book is like that too, you know, because you'll find that you have a problem in one part of the book and you'll find a solution to that. And it not only solves that problem, but it solves two other problems in different parts of the story, you know. Wow, okay, I'm on the right track now. You know, this baby's rolling. So what I try to do is I put the story first and foremost, and then it tells me what it's about. And then I can start reinforcing some of those ideas with little odds and ends and parts of the illustration and things.
David, do you have a test audience, or do you trust your sense of story and your sense of humor that if it makes sense to you, it's going to make sense for your intended audience?
I pretty much trust my own idiocy. hasn't failed me yet. But it is kind of a fine line between being funny and being just dumb. I used to try out stories on my daughter sometimes. My wife is a good reader, so she's a good one to bounce things off of. But I pretty much just sit up in my studio, the laboratory, and try to make myself chuckle.
I love it. Well, David, Mr. Noggin Body Gets a Hammer is out everywhere today. There are links to it in the show notes of this episode at hankgarner.com. We encourage everyone to go grab a copy and, go ahead and buy five. Everybody's got some nieces, nephews, kids, grandkids around. You know, get a stack of them to give away. They're, you know, it's going to be Christmas before we know it, for God's sake.
That's a very good idea, Hank.
Yeah. Help David out here. He's the Michelangelo of children's books.
As soon as that came out of my mouth, I went, whoa, no, I am not Michelangelo.
there's just stories out there waiting to be uncovered.
I'm a doodler.
Yeah. Well, David, I love what you're doing. I'm a big fan of your work. If people are just learning about you, is there a place where they can find you online and connect with you and dig into all the stuff that you do?
I have a website at knowdavidshannon.com, and I am also on Instagram, which is kind of new. I'm still getting used to that. And I think Instagram is DavidShannon2018.
Great. We're going to send everyone to see you. David, this has been so much fun chatting and getting to know you. Thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Well, thank you. It's been a great time.
Stay tuned now for an audiobook clip from Richard Gleeb's The Jason Crane Series.
I'm melting!
Cried Joey.
Take the picture already!
He stood with one arm around the bronze waist of the bewitched tribute statue, Samantha Stevens, riding a broom across a crescent moon. Jason tried in vain to frame the shot without any tourists in it, but that was impossible. From all points of the compass, a merry horde had arrived for Salem's two-day summer psychic fair. All the commuter trains had burst open, like cornucopias filled beyond capacity, spilling endless fruits and nuts onto the red brick sidewalks of Essex Street. A vampirist in lavender shorts and feathered boots sold maple chocolate walnut fudge in front of the Witch City Tattoo Parlor. A near-naked gypsy in purple-green veils danced with a pheasant in her arms around a plug-in Hanukkah menorah. A fat man in a fetching blue jeans dress sold amethyst and citrine charm bracelets in front of Medusa Cafe, but his stand got knocked over by a one-armed crone driving a mobility scooter who sang choo-choo as she passed, her stump on the wheel, her lipstick ghastly, her gnarled right hand raised in trailing plumes of noxious cigarette smoke. Chewbacca leapt out of her way and slapped sparks from his fur. He gave a disgruntled growl before going back to playing Summer Lovin' on his ukulele. The old one-armed dervish drove off, choo-choo, parting a crowd of wanderers, slack-jawed tourists with camera straps tight across their bellies, yellow-vested police on segways, elderly rollerbladers, face-painted infants and harried parents, and college girls. So many hot, hysterical college girls that you'd think somebody had napalmed a sorority house.
Jason, are you deaf?
Sorry. Jason raised the phone and took the shot. Joey inspected the photo and nodded in approval.
Your turn.
No, thanks.
Do it, Shaggy. Don't make me hex you.
Jason gave in and traded places. He put an arm around Samantha's metal back. Her bronze body had flushed in the afternoon sun, warm through his glove, but her eyes were weary. No, downright creepy. And her smile was forced, like a Disneyland princess who'd had her toe stomped.
Say chowder,
cried Joey, who'd been practicing his New England accent all morning.
Come on, man. Say chowder.
Fine, chowder. Joey got the shot, and Jason surrendered Samantha to a chubby kid wearing a Gandalf beard who climbed up to worship her bronze bosom.